I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:13, Wednesday, April 7th. This is the TDN Writers' Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And if you stay tuned, you might figure out what Bobby Flay's cat food has to do with this podcast.
Good morning. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. Joe, I have to ask you, what do you think of Sam Darnold being traded away?
I'm happy, man. They got three picks. That's more than I expected. It's good for both sides. He can start fresh in a better situation, and the Jets can finally start fresh with a new quarterback on the same timeline as the head coach and the GM. We've never had that.
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable, and Bill, with the Boston Red Sox 11th inning victory, they staved off being mathematically eliminated for the playoffs.
Well, that will happen by about Memorial Day anyway. So, and of course, I stayed up for 11 innings and they won it in the 12th last night.
There you go.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. The Keeneland Spring Meet is back. In case you didn't notice by all that great action over the weekend, we're going to get into all of it. Take in the excitement and celebrate Keeneland your way, whether at the track or at home, in celebration of the finest traditions of thoroughbred racing in the heart of Forest Country. Keeneland invites you to watch live on the Keeneland Race Day app, Facebook Live, or Keeneland.com. For more information, go to Keeneland.com/racing. So we had a veritable smorgasbord of three-year-old preps over the weekend, just great racing in general, not just the three-year-old preps. Huge cards at Keeneland and Aqueduct, Santa Anita. God, it was great to watch Keeneland racing. And it felt like it had been so long since we saw that track run with fans. And it was a beautiful sight, and it really made it feel like spring, no matter where you were, I think. So in terms of the three-year-old preps, I'm going to go from, I think, the most significant to the least significant. Most significant, I think, clearly was in the Bluegrass. That was a terrific race between Essential Quality and Highly Motivated. And I just love those races where the top two just spread away from the rest of the field on the far turn. And then they just throw down the rest of the way. It's fascinating to watch two horses accelerate together like that and leave like 10 other horses in their dust. I mean, that's what you're looking for when you have, you know, a couple of high class three-year-olds going at it. And I think it was the kind of race that neither horse deserved to lose. Although they both ran extremely well. I think it was kind of a no-brainer for Javier Castellano. Good to see Javier back riding to send Highly Motivated to the front. There was no speed on paper. But Essential Quality, I think that this is what sets him apart for me from the rest of the three-year-olds, is not just his consistency, he's 5 for 5 now, but also his versatility and the fact that he can press the pace like that and still have just as much left in the tank as him sitting back and making one run. And I just think that's so valuable for a Kentucky Derby horse because of the variance of paces that you may get when there's a 20 horse field lining up against each other. And this year, I don't think there's going to be a supersonic pace, but I think it's going to be solid. So I think, you know, that's his greatest asset to me, is that you can place him wherever you want. Luis Saez did a good job getting him into the race, but at the end of the day, he's just going to show up and have a strong stretch run. And he's a very admirable horse. And, you know, this is it. I think this is the best chance that Godolphin has had yet. I can't think of a better shot they've had at the Derby. And they've been trying to win the Derby for a while now. He's the 2-year-old champion. He's undefeated. He doesn't have a huge figure edge. I have to say that he got a 97 in the race on Saturday. I don't think he, as far as I know, I don't think he's cracked 100 yet so far in his career. But at the end of the day, he just shows up and he's versatile enough to adapt to whatever pace scenario he's presented with. So I thought that was a terrific race. Like I said, neither horse deserved to lose, but Essential Quality is just an extremely admirable 3-year-old. And he's one of the favorites that I'm not going to be against on Derby Day. I think there's a couple other short price horses that I might, you know, try to toss out of my exotics, but I definitely am not doing that with him. I think he's the real deal for sure. And that leads me to the Santa Anita race with Rock Your World going wire to wire in the Santa Anita Derby, the Run Happy Santa Anita Derby. He got 100 buyer. He's an interesting case because this was only his third start. His first two starts were on the turf. It's pretty rare to see a horse go you know, first time dirt and win a grade one race, especially like that. I got to say, if you guys can throw up the photo of Umberto Rispoli, how cool did he look with that mask on with like the teeth on it and then the blacked out goggles? Just looked very badass, you know, as he was crossing the wire in that race. And he's this interesting story as well. He was the guy who, when he first came to Santa Anita, wasn't doing that well. He was thinking of going back to Europe. And now look at him. Now it's him and Flavien Prada, I think, basically winning every big race in California. So shout out to him. I don't know what to make of the horse on Derby Day. I think it's too hard with that one race sample size to figure out what he's going to do in a better field, because the Santa Anita Derby was not a great field. Like Medina Spirit kind of ran his usual race and was second. Dream Shake, I think, you know, probably should pass on the Derby and point for some races later in the year, maybe at one turn. So not sure what to make of him, but obviously an extremely impressive performance going turf to dirt and only a third career start. And then the other race was the Wood Memorial, which was painful for me because I needed Dynamic One. I thought I was smart as hell sniffing him out at 15-1. And, you know, he made the first run and just got tagged late by Bourbonic at 72-1. We're going to talk to Todd Pletcher a little bit later. You know, just when you think Todd might not have a Derby contender, he's got Known Agenda. And these two, yeah, he's got four horses now that are likely to start in the Derby. So you can never count Todd out. And the other thing I wanted to mention before I toss it to Bill about that race is, how about Kendrick Carmouche? This is a guy who has, you know, really stuck it out in the winters at Aqueduct for all these years, which is not an easy place to ride in the winter. New York is cold enough in the winter, but if you don't know, Aqueduct's right on Jamaica Bay. So the winds get blown out there, not to mention the airports nearby. It is miserable to be out there in the winter. And he's stuck it out. And now look, he's been rewarded by winning Aqueduct's two biggest races in the span of 4 months. He won the Cigar Mile in True Timber, and then he won the Wood Memorial with Bourbonic on Saturday, and just a perfect last to first ride. So shout out to Kendrick Carmouche, who's a real blue collar rider and has put in the hard yards at Aqueduct over the years to deserve this kind of success. Toss it to Bill.
Yeah, why don't we take it one race at a time? I'll start with you, since you started with the Bluegrass at Kingland. I'll start with that as well. I mean, you can't knock Essential Quality. There's no flaws in this horse whatsoever. When you look at his pedigree, his running style, even the speed figures, you know, he doesn't blow you away. But mainly the fact that there's always just a one next to his name every time out. But, Joe, I'm thinking that if Concert Tour runs away and hides from the field in the Arkansas Derby, he might actually be the Derby favorite and not Essential Quality. I think the reasons why with these ifs is the Baffert factor. I mean, everybody's going to, who's Baffert going to win the Kentucky Derby with? And Essential Quality, we know what he is now. He's not going to take your breath away. He's not going to win by 10. He's not going to run a 109 buyer or something like that. He's just going to show up. He's going to do his job and run his race. So it's been good enough every single start of his career. But, you know, I'm with you. I would never throw this horse out. But at the same time, I don't think, you know, you can look at him with any level of certainty. Or, you know, I have a friend who plays the Derby Superfecta every year and always tries to hit it for like 25,000, 30,000. Yeah, I don't think you could go Essential Quality all or something like that. You know, he's going to run his race. It'll be a matter of if it is good enough. And also, it is remarkable that Godolphin is now in this position after trying so many years. Either have the favorite or the second choice for the Kentucky Derby. And you know what? It would be nice to see them rewarded for their perseverance and all that they've been doing for U.S. racing. So, you know, I'll give Rock Your World and, excuse me, Essential Quality an A-. How about that?
Wow, that's a tough grade, Bill Finley. That's an A- for a horse that was champion two-year-old and undefeated this year. But I understand what you're saying as far as from the optic test. He didn't blow by the field. He did win. He grinded it out, or grounded out, I guess, technically is what we should say. I think you're right. He's either going to be, you know, favorite or co-favorite, depending on how things go this weekend at the Arkansas Derby. But, you know, for me, Essential Quality is the champ until proven otherwise. That's why when we did our contest and you picked them, I was like, because that was really the horse that I, you know, definitely wanted to see in the race. And to watch his campaign go forward. We're not talking about Highly Motivated at all, but that was a really good performance by Highly Motivated. First time going two turns, had to ship down, you know, from Aqueduct down to Keeneland. And really for the majority of the race, really looked like that he was going to, you know, he was going to get there. And here's a horse who, like, his only blemish on his resume is when he bobbled in the start in the Gotham and, you know, almost won that race, finished third, lost by like a length or so. And, you know, really should be also recognized as one of the top contenders, you know, for the Kentucky Derby. I thought Highly Motivated ran a very, very good race. And here's a horse that, you know, broke the track record at Keeneland in the Nyquist on the undercard of the Breeders' Cup, you know, group last year, came back. It didn't run until the Gotham, had an excuse in the Gotham, and now just maybe got a little bit tired in the Bluegrass. But for my money, I like both those two horses. And Joe, you said it best, you know, it was really astonishing to me at this stage of the game that you're starting to see these top horses start to pull away from the rest of the field. And I think you can realistically say that Highly Motivated, Essential Quality, you know, ran against the best group of horses out of the three preps, and they ran away from the fields accordingly. I know we're going to go kind of, you know, race by race after this, but there was one thing that I noticed also in the winner's circle of all the race. Oh, there was one key component, I should say, of all the horses that were in the winner's circles of the, you know, of these preps. And that is breeding. You know, you look at a horse like Essential Quality, obviously Tap It, you know, one of the top sires in our generation, if not the top horse, you know, other than maybe Into Mischief. And out of a mare, an Elusive Quality mare, who was stakes placed in seven different times. And that was Delightful Quality. And Delightful Quality is a half sister to Folklore, who was a champion 2 year old, won the Breeders' Cup, you know, juvenile filly, and made $1 million. So, you know, we talk about where are these horses coming from and what genetic backgrounds are they, are, you know, do they evolve from? You look at Essential Quality and just bred up the wazoo, you know, top to bottom on both sides of the pedigree. And you would almost, you know, when you look back and you say the horse is undefeated and winning all these preps and graded stake races, probably one of the favorites for the Derby. You can understand based on the genealogy and based on, you know, the success that his family has had on the racetrack. It's not a shocker. And you'll see that theme in the other two winners as we go through, you know, the Wood and the Santa Anita Derby as well.
Are you going to tell me that Bourbonic wasn't a shocker at 72-1?
Well, I'm not saying it wasn't a shocker. I mean, wrong, but I will tell you, we'll look at the pedigree page and you'll be like, oh, okay. Yeah. In hindsight, that actually makes some sense that he can go a mile and an eighth.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, we talked to Mike Stidham. He was talking about that with the Godolphin sire and mare power. That's like, it gets to a certain point where it's like these horses kind of have to be good. You know, you get enough of these blue blood horses, some of them are going to eventually be able to run. Essential Quality certainly can run. Just wanted to run down some of the other stuff from the weekend for me, and then you guys can talk about what stood out to you. I keep waiting for somebody in the three-year-old filly division to have like this breakout performance, and it just doesn't happen. It's kind of crazy, honestly, that no one has like really just burst out with this huge run to just say, like, look, I'm the best of these relatively bad three-year-old fillies. But there were a couple of big races for three-year-old fillies over the weekend. The Grade One Ashland at Keeneland, that was a pretty decent little stretch run as well. Malathot finished fast to get up and beat Pass the Champagne. I said this on Twitter at the time, but I want Pass the Champagne going forward. I think, you know, that was only her third start. It was her first start going around two turns. She'd only gotten seven at Gulfstream. And just for her to be that close and just to get run down by a filly who definitely has a good late kick, if nothing else, I thought that was a pretty damn good effort, you know, first time going that far. So, and I think she has more forward to go than Malathot. At Aqueduct, Search Results won the Gazelle. She got a 92 buyer, which is a pretty solid number. It was crazy to watch those Aqueduct races because every race was like 154 and change. And that was one of the dullest tracks I've seen on a big day at Aqueduct in a long time. So I kept watching the final times being like, oh, well, that must be a slow race. Well, that must be a slow race. It's like, no, the track is just slow. So Search Results is three for three. She's obviously got some talent for ground. Mischievous Alex, you know, we were waiting for him to get back into top class competition, and he did in the Carter, and he certainly showed up in a big way, had a runaway win, got a 109 buyer. So I struggle to think of a top sprinter that I would take over him, like I said before, unless Charlatan turns back and comes back and wants to run at seven furlongs to a mile. I'm going to take him over. I'm going to take Mischievous Alex over basically everybody. Overall, it was a great weekend of racing at Keeneland. I mean, it was just quality horses, one race after another. But another thing that I took away is Luis Saez and Joel Rosario owned those stakes races. I believe there were 10 stakes over the weekend at Keeneland, or 9 stakes, I believe. And Joel won 6 and Luis won 3. So I was talking about this on Twitter, you know, between those two and Irad, who's doing Irad things, Jose Ortiz is starting to pick up again. Javier Castellanos back. Johnny V's riding well. He went out to California and won a couple of races. That Belmont jockey colony is going to be an absolute war at the end of this month. And I can't wait for it. It's obviously always New York colonies in these warmer months are always terrific. But this year, especially, I just feel like there are so many guys who are just riding at the top of their game. And it's going to be a war. It's going to be even like a guy like Eric Cancel, a guy who I thought was going to get washed out of New York a year or two ago. And he was, you know, he was struggling. He was in the, you know, in the single digit percentage wise riding. Now he won the Aqueduct winter meet title, and he's, you know, he's, I think, starting to take that step forward as a jockey. So just overall, it's going to be fascinating to watch the Belmont jockey standings. Now that I say that, I rattle win by 30 freaking mounts, but anyway, on paper, at least it looks extremely interesting. Just a couple other thoughts. Bound for Nowhere dominated the Shaker Town 105 buyer. He's a horse that, you know, doesn't, he runs by appointment, but when he's right, he's a really nice turf sprinter. Jouster in the Appalachian. I thought, you know, the top three in that race are all very nice fillies, but Jouster clearly had the easiest trip. The second and third finishers, Plum Ollie, he made a nice run from the back. They were closing into a 22 and change final quarter. So I think that bodes well for the top three in that race, especially the second and third horses who were against it from a pace standpoint. That's pretty Gamine. I got to mention Gamine as well. Other than that, Gamine came back. She won the Las Flores on Sunday at Santa Anita. Pretty easily got a 98 buyer, so it was good to see her back and running. I'm interested to see where she goes next. But yeah, I mean, who else do you want? Pauline's Pearl won the Fantasy, another like ho-hum 3-year-old filly prep race. So yeah, overall, it was a terrific, terrific weekend of racing, particularly at Keeneland. Shout out to everybody at the TDN who was working on Saturday, because that's not an easy day to work with all those graded stakes and everything going on at once. So shout out to my coworkers there. But anything other thoughts from you guys before we wrap up this monster weekend recap?
Well, Joe, I don't necessarily have a thought, but I want to discuss some news that involves one of our friends on the podcast. John Green, could you please take us through the decision to put Julian Leperoux aboard Helium in the Kentucky Derby?
Wow. Okay. This is a very spontaneous, actually, conversation. I didn't think it was going to be asked this. So the decision, the short version is that we're very, very pleased to have a rider of the caliber of Leperoux riding Helium in the Kentucky Derby. I will tell you that it was a very difficult decision deciding between keeping Jose Ferrer, who did an excellent job riding him in the Tampa Bay Derby, and one of the other jockeys, you know, of interest, who had ridden in the Kentucky Derby before and had a little bit more experience at Churchill Downs. When we were playing the game of jockey musical chairs, and I don't have my chart here. I do have my chart here in front of me. You know, what we do is we went through all the top contenders, you know, as far as points and who was riding. And basically we saw that there were no less than, in our estimation, there were going to be no less than 7 horses that were going to need riders after this weekend coming up. And that's because, you know, certain riders had won on multiple candidates. So we sat down as a group and decided what is going to be best for the horse. And basically it came down to our opportunity to have somebody like Julian ride the horse, who obviously is a top rider, mostly on turf, but also has had some big races, won on the dirt. He's won some grade one races for Mark Cassie in the past. He was very anxious to ride this horse in particular. But the one thing that actually put it over the top, that tipped the scales for us, is that the horse actually moved to Churchill Downs this week. And because of COVID restrictions, unless you're riding there on a regular basis, jockeys don't have access to the backstretch. So the only way that we would be able to have a jockey to work the horse in the morning and get to know the horse, and, you know, if he has any idiosyncrasies, but just being in tune with the horse, is to pick a rider who is riding regularly at Churchill Downs. And when we put all of those different, you know, variables together, That's why we came up with Julien Laperrue to ride the horse. He was very excited to ride the horse, and we're looking forward to having that team together. You know, that's not to say that Jose did a poor job. He did an excellent job on him in the Tampa Bay Derby, and we will continue to ride Jose on a number of our horses, and looking forward to have him ride a number of our horses at Monmouth Park as well. So it was a really, really difficult decision, but ultimately we were trying to do what's best for our opportunity to win the race. And we just felt like, you know, having Julien be able to ride the horse in the mornings, you know, for a couple of times before the race would ultimately put us over the top as far as, you know, having the best option for Helium. Joe, you mentioned that there were, you know, I think there were 16 graded stake races this weekend and 25 overall. I mean, we didn't even get to a majority of them. We kind of glossed over a couple of them. But one of the ones I wanted to touch base on that you had mentioned before was the Carter, was Mischievous Alex winning the grade one Carter in New York. And obviously I want to mention it because Cassius King is partners with us on a number of horses, and Chuck Zachney and Glenn Bennett are just phenomenal individuals. So I was very happy to see them win. But, you know, what a good job they've done with this horse since moving it, you know, over to the Safi Joseph's barn. He's undefeated. They put an extension blinker on him that I think really focused him. And they shortened him up to, you know, 6 and 7 furlongs. And the horse exploded all three races. But in this race in particular, in the Carter, you know, he went 6 furlongs in 10 and 2 and finished up in 23 and 4. And Joe, you alluded to this before. The Wood Memorial, and I know you can't compare apples to oranges because that was a 3-year-old's and going long, but the Wood, they went 6 furlongs in 1:14. And the Gazelle, they went 6 furlongs in 1:15. That's how dead the racetrack was, you know, for these route races. So for a couple of races earlier, for Mischievous Alex to go 1:10 and 2 for 6 furlongs is just mind blowing. And that's why, you know, he got a 109 buyer in comparison to the other races. But it's been phenomenal for me to watch this horse develop and explode down the racetrack. You know, and I'm happy that Cassius King, you know, is going to be campaigning him. And they said it looks like they're going to keep him in New York for the next couple of races. So it was in a great, phenomenal weekend of racing. That one's, you know, stood out for me outside of the 3-year-old preps. It was just, it was an amazing feat.
Yeah. And he, like I said, he's a dynamite sprinter. That was the first grade one of the year in New York. It's a little disappointing to see that race draw only 5 horses. Hopefully he gets a little, only thing I would say as a knock on him so far this year is that all three races he's won have been 4 and 5 horse field. So I'm a little bit more interested once he gets into a bigger field, you know, maybe has a little pace pressure, a little traffic, you know, something like that. I think that might be a little bit more of an acid test, but yeah, like I said, you know, he's the best one turn horse in America until I see otherwise. I wanted to transition from John's discussion about Helium to the leaderboard of the Kentucky Derby point standing so far. Now, there will be a little bit of movement, I think, this weekend with the Arkansas Derby. I don't know, maybe someone will show up in the Lexington, which I think they've brought it back a week, which I think is really smart, instead of running it 2 weeks before the Derby when you're not going to get anybody really. This time, at least you'll get some of the spillover from the Arkansas Derby. But I just wanted to kind of run through what the field looks like right now. So if we can splash up a graphic with the top 20 plus in the standings, there's going to be a little bit of movement. There's probably going to be a couple horses who opt out who are high up in the standings. I think of Rebel Romance, who's number 5 right now with 100 points via his UAE Derby win. I don't think it's necessarily guaranteed that he's going to come over. I think in a year where Godolphin had a lesser chance without horses like Essential Quality, I think they might be more inclined to send Rebel's Romance over, but I'm not 100% sure they're going to do that now. Just looking down the field, I mean, I think, you know, other than that, I think most of the top 20 are going to run. Helium is number 15 for John. So they're solidly in that race. I don't know, maybe Soup and Sandwich cuts back, decides to pass on the Derby. But right now the cutoff point is 40 points. Crowded Trade and Sainthood are 19 and 20 at 40 points each. And just outside of that are Rombauer and Proxy at 34 points, and then Hidden Stash at 32, Dream Shake at 30, and Obesos at 25. So without a big win or a big performance this weekend from somebody outside of that top 25, I think you're basically looking at the Derby field, give or take a few horses. And I just wanted to, you know, maybe get a few early thoughts from you guys. Obviously we're going to have to adjust based on next week's results. And then we're going to have 3 weeks to really dig into the Derby field. But I'm just wondering, outside of the favorites, outside of the big horses, who you guys are interested in, just looking at that, that list. For me, there's a couple. I think Mandaloon, you know, I'm not a big fan of, you know, just excusing horses, terrible races just because, but he had done so well up to that. And I think he's going to be a bigger price than he should be because of the one bad race. So he's a little interesting for me. I'm interested to see what kind of number Highly Motivated goes off at, because I think, you know, there's going to be too big of a gap in the odds between him and Essential Quality, considering the gap on the track was only a neck. I was seeking suspicion that Highly Motivated will get off at 20-1 plus. Other than that, it looks like a relatively chalky Derby, but I think without Life Is Good in the race, chalky means something different. Chalky is going to mean 7-2, 4-1, 5-1 instead of 8-5. So I just wondered if you had any, maybe Midnight Bourbon. That's another one I'll give a shot to. At a big price. I think he's bred for the mile and a quarter, and he's another one who, you know, ran well early in the season, and then kind of, you know, the bloom came off the rose a little bit later in the prep season. So he's another one I would look at a price, but I'm wondering if you guys have any ideas for anybody outside of the major contenders in the Derby.
Well, Joe, actually, I don't want to go outside the major contenders because I think they're going to dominate the Derby. And I agree with you. I mean, it's not, you know, we're not going to have a 6-5 favorite. I think the favorite, whoever is going to be, you know, likely Essential Quality at this point, be in the neighborhood of 7-2, 4-1, something like that. But the one horse you didn't mention that, and I don't think we talked quite enough about this horse, is Rock Your World, coming out of the Santa Anita Derby. So we've never seen a Derby contender quite like this, where he makes his dirt debut, as you said, in a Grade One race. So you really, from assessing him for the Derby, you really only have one race to go off of. The Santa Anita Derby. What he did earlier in his career in the Pasadena on the grass does not really, you know, bode or give you any emphasis or indication of how well he can do in the Kentucky Derby. You're not going to take a grass race like that and then project what he's going to do in the Derby. So, you know, look at the factors he's got. You talked a lot about the horses and the versatility, a little bit early speed, but don't have to go to the front. That's him. John Sadler has never had any success in the Kentucky Derby. It's not really his specialty, but he's a terrific trainer. And, you know, maybe sometimes we talk too much about speed figures, but with Life Is Good out, he, at this point, is more or less the fastest horse because he's the only one in the field with a triple-digit buyer, which he got 100 winning the Santa Anita Derby. So I think he's a very interesting candidate for the Derby. But, back to the chalkiness of the Derby, if you could play the favorite and the third and fifth choice in the Derby in Exacta Box, and if you hit it, it might pay $125. So because, again, you're talking about horses that have a good chance that are in the 8-10-1 neighborhood. So, yeah, I mean, Rock Your World, I think, is somebody that really needs a second look when it comes to the race.
Yeah, and Bill, I agree with what you're saying as far as, you know, the top contenders are still, you know, the behemoths in the race until proven otherwise. If you're looking outside of that immediacy of the favorites, we also haven't talked about Hot Rod Charlie a lot. And here's a horse that ran second to Essential Quality at 90-1 in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile race. Nobody really expected him to put that kind of a move in, and he hasn't done anything wrong yet. I mean, he's run his races. You know, he won the Louisiana Derby like he was supposed to. He, again, from a breeding standpoint, he's a half to Matoli. So, you know, that the family throws Grade One winners all, you know, before. I think they've done a good job of managing him, you know, bringing him over east, you know, from California to Louisiana. And now they're going to go a little bit north to Kentucky. And I think he's a horse that I believe, if I remember correctly, ran like a 98 or a 99 buyer to win the Louisiana Derby. So it's not even like he's that far off in the buyer figures. I know in the sheet numbers, you know, the top contenders are all, you know, around that number 3 plus or minus. But I think that that's a horse that we've kind of forgotten about, that has the breeding, has the past performances, and has the speed figures. And I think is rounding into the right kind of a horse that maybe is a dark horse outside of the immediate horses that are going to be, you know, the favorites in the race. You know, and again, as a homer, you can say, well, you know, all the arguments that you just gave Rock Your World save the Hunter Buyer. You could also say the same thing for Helium, because here's a horse that had never run in the dirt before, never run two turns before, and albeit in an easier field than the Tampa Bay Derby, did win impressively. And again, did do what he was supposed to do after a longer layoff. But I'm not going to sit here and on a soapbox and say that he's as good as, you know, the top contender.
You would never do that. You would never.
We're
going
to need a lot of racing luck, obviously, to, you know, to be able to win. But that's the beautiful thing about the Kentucky Derby, is that none of these horses have run in, you know, really 12 horse fields, let alone 20 horse fields. So you have to have tactical speed. You have to be able to get out there and get your position, and have a lot of racing luck, because to navigate yourself through, you know, half a dozen horses ahead of you or 10 horses ahead of you and be able to meander your way around there is a really daunting task. So I think right now to try to guess who some of the dark horses are going to be might be a little premature, because we really have to see how the past perform, excuse me, how the post draw is going to be, because I think that's a really important component in all this. But I personally don't remember a Derby class that, you know, is really top to bottom kind of as even as this group is. You could really genuinely make a case for about a dozen horses. And if you look at all the pundits that are, you know, on the internet, giving their top 10 or their top the Derby dozen or whatever it is, there's like the same half a dozen horses. And then after five or six, there's a, you know, you can kind of throw them all up in the air and see where they land. You can make a case for a number of horses in this race.
Yeah. And I love John's, a person such as me would never get on a soapbox to advocate for a horse such as Helium. But yeah, I mean, listen, he'll be on my tickets. Whether or not I knew John, I would include Helium at least in the exotics, just because I think he's going to be a huge price because the buyer number was low for the Tampa Bay Derby, but he looks a lot better on the sheets than he does on the buyer figures. And he's got potential as well. I don't know about Leperu or the layoff, but he's definitely got the talent to factor, I would think. As to the two horses that you guys brought up, Rocky World, I think it's a lot is going to depend on what kind of price he is. And I think that big figure is going to make him a little bit of an underlay. And just, he did run very well. I got to say he set a fast pace and kept going and always looked like a winner, even when he was like sloppy with his lead changes in a stretch, he still was going pretty powerfully. And, you know, I'm not going to toss him out completely, but I just, off that one race, if he's single digits, I don't think he's one of the better bets. The better bet for me, like John mentioned, is Hot Rod Charlie, because I think he might get lost a little bit. I think he, you know, the Louisiana Derby, I think, was far enough back in people's minds that they're going to be more enamored with horses like Concert Tour and Essential Quality, who have run more recently than he has. But he has that versatility too. You know, he's come from off the pace and then he went to the front in the Louisiana Derby and kept going. So he has that kind of Essential Quality. You can place him wherever you want. And the other thing for him is, I don't know, I think that mile and 3/16 long stretch of the fairgrounds of the Louisiana Derby is the best prep for the Kentucky Derby stretch of the season. I just think that's most similar for the kind of, you know, shots you're going to take in the stretch of the Kentucky Derby. It's one of the longest stretches in America, and a mile and about 3/16, you know, just in my mind, seems a lot closer to a mile and a quarter than a mile and an eighth, even if it's only a 16th of a mile. It just feels a lot longer to me, especially with that stretch. So he's definitely interesting for sure. So in the biggest news of the week, Bobby Flay has a new cat food that he just released, and the commercial sounds a little familiar. See if you can pick up on the similarities.
Hey everybody, I'm Bobby Flay. You might know me as a chef, but just as importantly, I'm a cat person. And I want you to say hello to Nacho Flay. Obviously, he's incredibly important to me.
All right, so Bobby, there's an easier way to tell us you're a fan of the show. I mean, this is a little too subliminal of a message for me. If you want to come on the show, if you want to send us some fan mail, please do. But we appreciate you picking up the theme song as well. So it looks delicious.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. and this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. Okay, so we have our handle numbers now for the entire first quarter of 2021. Something that we update every now and then on the show, especially since the handle numbers have looked more positive over the last year. We were waiting for the full first quarter numbers, and we have them now. And wagering is up significantly. Wagering for the three-month period from January 1st to March 31st was reported at $2.776 billion, which is an increase of 10.27% from last year. And daily average wagering was $3.6 million about, which represented a 14.15% improvement from 12 months ago. Now, the caveat obviously here is that the coronavirus pandemic hit in mid-March, in most of America, hit in mid-March last year. That's when everything went into lockdown. So it's not quite an apples to apples comparison. Stuff is basically back up and running at 100% right now. But that's why I think it was important to get this data from all 3 months together. And purses are up as well. I don't want to slight the owners and the horsemen here too, because that's a big deal. Nearly $215 million in purses were distributed, 4.6% better than last year, and average purses per race day for the first quarter was a little over $280,000, which is up 8.45% from 2020. So overall, very good news from the economic indicators. I'm continuing to be the optimist on the panel here about the handle numbers. I do think that the sport grew a little bit in the last year. Obviously, maybe you want the whole year to figure out whether or not it's sustainable. But with fewer racing days, I just think that there has been an uptick in wagering, even if it's a small one. I think it's significant, and purses getting back up to the levels that I think they were before the pandemic hit is a big deal. So I wonder if you guys have any thoughts on these numbers on either side.
Joe, I'm going to take the glasses half empty again on this, if you'll allow me for a minute. I mean, first of all, it's very hard to make any comparison. Maybe we should just say it's meaningless because you're comparing COVID numbers when you had five racetracks in the country running versus now everybody's up and running. You have dozens of racetracks. But the stat that I thought was most illuminating, why I'm going to throw cold water on all your enthusiasm, was the stat you gave up about average wagering per race day. It's up 14.5%. Now, that's good on the surface, 14.5%, but should it be much better than that? I mean, it's still because you had so much less racing in 2020. And I still think you're right. Let's talk about this at the end of the year and see where we're at. But it still looks to me like you can make a case that there's just so much money out there to be bet on horse racing. And if it's going to be split among five tracks or among 25 tracks, it's really not that different. So, if you look at that and consider everything that was going on, and also you had the fact that racing was going against no sports gambling, et cetera, I'm not sure the figures are that good.
Yeah, and Bill, we talked about that earlier on. I mean, in other shows, you're exactly right that it took a freaking pandemic and no competition for our numbers to increase. So I'm kind of looking at it also through a different lens. But the one thing that stood out to me when it came to these numbers is the fact that it's the less is more. There were less tracks and less races that were being run, and there was more wagering. So basically, in a very fundamental way of looking at it, there were less tracks open, which means there were more horses that were running, per race, more starters per race, which led to more wagering. So again, it goes back to the argument of we have too many goddamn racetracks open right now. And especially on the East Coast, we looked at a very small sample of the three-year-old fillies, for example, and there weren't enough three-year-old fillies to run in the top races, the top Oaks preps. They had six horse fields, four horse fields in these grade twos, you know, preps. And we couldn't get enough horses there because there were just too many of them out there. So I think as an industry, we have to be willing to kind of scuttle some of these racetracks that just aren't performing anymore, because it's going to be for the greater good. It's going to be where instead of running in three horse fields, which again, as an owner, I love running a three or four horse field because it means that I'm pretty much guaranteed of not only hitting the board, but probably getting some black type for my horses, which adds a lot of value to the rest of the family. But in reality, you know, you have to look at what generates the money for purses, and that's gambling. And the gamblers want 7, 8, 12 horse fields. And they want to have all the exotic wagering that they can muster and they can have, you know, on their plate. And the only way to do that is by having less racetracks and more starters per race. So to me, that was the glaring, you know, blinking light out of all of these statistics, is that less is more. And as an industry, we have to recognize that.
You know, my feelings on that, I totally agree. I think that there are smaller tracks who are doing the right things. Bill had a story on Sam Houston the other day, which is slash takeout and seen immense growth in handle because of it. We talked to Andrew Offerman from Canterbury Park a couple of weeks ago, another small track that does things the right way. So I think, you know, there are small tracks that are trying to navigate this, you know, landscape competing against the top tracks. And there are some of them that are doing it right. And there are some of them that are just kind of existing and floundering. So I think that consolidation is going to be better over time. But I think that it's up to smaller tracks like those, like Sam Houston and Canterbury, to show why they're valuable to the landscape. And I think that they've done that, and a lot of other smaller tracks have not. Just to put a bow on it, the number of live racing days for this quarter, the first quarter this year, was down from last year's. So it was down slightly, 3.4%. The number of races staged was fractionally higher than last year. So even with the difference between all the shutdowns towards the back half of March last year, there still were fewer racing days this first quarter, last first quarter. So I think that's significant. But yep, I'll be the ray of sunshine here for this one until I see handle go back down, because so far it's been mostly positive the last year and change. All right, so I felt like I should mention this this week. Ray Pollock actually put me onto this. He tweeted about it over the weekend. It was actually a tweet from Darren Revelle, who's a sports business reporter, and he was talking about this game, this NFT game called Zed Run, that's really blowing up right now. And this is going to be a funny segment because I know very little about this and John and Bill know nothing about it. So I'm going to like finagle my way through it. And I'm sure, like, if you have any corrections you want to send my way or any feedback to kind of straighten me out on this, feel free. But the basic premise, if you don't know what an NFT is, it stands for non-fungible token. And it's kind of this blowing up crypto asset sector that's really exploding. The NBA had a crypto slash NFT thing called Top Shot, where you can like purchase highlights of like LeBron dunking, or, you know, it's basically a digital, it's a way to digitally make things unique and one of a kind, and you can say, like, it's like art, it's like digital art that you can get verified through crypto and the blockchain and all that crap. But there's a racing one that's happening right now, like I said, called Zed Run, and it is exploding. They, you know, every once in a while they do these drops where they sell virtual racehorses, and supposedly the last one sold out like within minutes. And they keep growing in terms of, you know, downloads and engagement. And it's pretty expansive. Like, you can race horses for real money. You can sell them. You can breed them. Like, and if you look at the comments and people like replying to Zed Run and like everybody else who's doing it, that's people that have familiarized themselves with the lingo of the sport within this virtual world. And it's, I don't know what to make of it just yet, because it's different from other virtual games in that it's real money and it's capitalizing on this crypto boom that's happening. So my question, and I don't expect you guys to answer this, but my question just to figure out going forward is whether or not any of this is translatable to the real world of racing and getting people involved with that, because obviously this is much easier. You can just do it sitting at home at your computer. Just put money in through Ethereum or one of those other coins, and all of a sudden you have a stable full of virtual racehorses, but they can appreciate in value, and you can watch the races and watch them race against each other. I don't know. It's fascinating to me that this kind of thing is so popular when we can't even get people, young people, to get into the actual racing game. Now, obviously, it's a higher barrier to entry. There's more physical work that needs to be done. But I just from watching these people talk about it, it's like, if you didn't know that they were talking about a game, you would have thought that they were people in the racing industry with like the lingo that they were using. So I don't know a ton about it yet. All I know is that it's blowing up in popularity, and I wonder how big it gets, you know, whether or not people in racing are going to be able to kind of latch onto that and try to, you know, maybe do some cross marketing or something like that. It's definitely very interesting. Should watch this space. Where I'm going to keep an eye on it and, you know, see how, where it goes from here, but it's super interesting. Go check them out on Twitter, Zed Run, or you can go to Zed.run on your web browser. And it's pretty fascinating. You can watch races without having any, you know, any stake in it. So we'll keep an eye on that, but it's definitely interesting just to get people interested in the lingo and the ins and outs of racing, even if it's virtual. I think can't be a bad thing necessarily for the sport. So we'll see if we can, you know, hold on to grasp any of that momentum in the future, but it's definitely something worth watching, especially for the people above us and the top echelons of the decision-making process in racing.
I remember playing a game on Nintendo called like Champion Jockey or Championship Jockey. And I used to love that game because it was the same thing. Like you could breed your own horses and develop them and, you know, you could have sprinters or turf horses or just, and that was really, really fun, but there was no interaction. I guess now what they're saying is like, you can actually do it like Halo style, where you have a group of other people and you can compete against other stables, and that's how they increase in value by, you know, purse earnings and stuff like that. Like it's a fascinating, interesting concept.
Yeah, like I remember Gallop Racer. I used to play Gallop
Racer. That's what it was. Gallop Racer.
Which was a pretty good game, honestly. But yeah, this is another level because it's actual money, and it's, I don't know, I think it more approximates the racing world because it's kind of all encompassing for these people, for the people that are getting involved. It's like it becomes part of their lifestyle, and it's not just a video game. So it's, like I said, it's super interesting, and we'll see where it goes from here. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills, fraction of the bills, experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week, we're honored to have him back on the show and be able to see his face this time, Todd Pletcher. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, so we're glad to have you. Obviously, huge weekend for you. Ran 1-2 in the Wood Memorial. I don't remember the last time I saw Todd Pletcher win at 72-1. Generally, a guy of your stature doesn't get let go at that price. So my question is, what did you think of them going into the race? And then how did they run compared to your expectations?
Well, in Bourbonic's case, I mean, it was what I would describe as a pleasant surprise. He's a horse that's always trained well. And we did think getting around two turns up to a mile and an eighth was going to be to his benefit. But, you know, I'd be lying if I said we expected him to win. But, you know, the strategy was, let's let him fall back, make one run. He should get the distance, and hopefully he's picking up the pieces towards the end, which he definitely was. And so, but I can't tell you I had a $20 win ticket on him.
But I was looking for it, Todd. All right. But just also on Dynamic One, he obviously ran a huge race. You're definitely going to press forward with both of them to the Derby, I assume.
that's the plan. And in Dynamic One's case, I mean, we were expecting him to run well, and we've been a little disappointed in what he's done so far, because he's always trained like a good horse. And, you know, he's in his debut, he completely missed the break. In his second start, he ran into Greatest Honor from a bad post at Gulfstream, made the lead idle a little bit. Then his third start at Gulfstream was the one that really kind of left us scratching our heads when he finished fourth that day. But again, he drew an outside post going a mile and 16th at Gulfstream, which is always a concern. And so we got him up to Aqueduct. He ran two expectations and you know, made another step forward in the wood. I think he's still learning how to run, learning how to finish off the race, and he got a little bit lost by himself, and I think Bourbonic surprised him a little bit. But you know, that type of performance is what we've been seeing from him in the mornings to indicate he's of that quality.
Ty, congratulations on another great weekend for you and your stable, not just with three-year-olds, but all over the map. Let's go to Known Agenda now, who I think it's fair to say is your number one contender for the Kentucky Derby. In just a span of a couple months and a couple races, he went from a horse that, you know, ran a mediocre race in Sam F. Davis to the horse that galloped in the Florida Derby. I know you used equipment change, you had blinkers on for him. But, you know, what's the story behind that transition from, you know, again, a horse that couldn't even win a minor prep to a horse that wins the Florida Derby?
Well, I think a lot of it's just physical maturity, mental maturity. He's a curlin. He's bred to be better a little later. What surprised us about him was he was able to be competitive in his debut at 6.5 furlongs. He stretched out in his second start off that 1 6.5 furlong race, was able to beat Greatest Honor in a mile and 1/8 race. They were 20 lengths clear of the third horse. The Remsen, if you look back at it, he was still green. He was stuck inside on a sloppy track. Once he got clear late, he put in a good final 16th, but you know, he'd left himself too much to do. And the same thing in the Sam Davis. He just simply left himself way too much to do early on in the race. His last 16th of a mile, I think, was the best in the Sam Davis, but you know, he was in a hopeless position before that. So I think the blinkers have made a big difference. It's allowed him to get focused earlier in the race, put himself in a more stalking type position. And you know, the exciting thing about the group that we have is I think they're all horses that are going to improve at a mile and a quarter, that they're all horses that are truly looking for that distance.
And Todd, you mentioned one curlin in Known Agenda. I'm going to shift gears to another curlin you had some success with this weekend, and actually throughout her entire racing career, with Malathot, who ran a phenomenal race, I think, in the Grade One Ashland, and is undefeated now after four starts. $1 million plus purchase as a yearling, and looks like she's fulfilling everyone's expectations. Tell us a little bit about that filly and how she's rounding into shape for the Oaks.
Yeah, she's a really special filly. She's been great since day one, and she was a spectacular yearling, which is why she cost what she did. And being a daughter of Dreaming of Julia, who we trained, we knew she was a top class filly and mare also. But she's a joy to train. She's so professional, and you know, we kind of got a little bit behind schedule. We had a little hiccup midwinter. We're originally going to go in the Devana Dell, and then we got postponed to the Gulfstream Oaks, and then we had the misfortune of Sheikh Hamdan passing away. So, you know, the Ashland turned out to be kind of our third choice. And, you know, I thought turning for home, you know, especially with the short run to the first wire at Keeneland, that she had too much to do. But, I mean, she really leveled off the last part. And I think if I remember right, ran the last quarter in like 23.49, which is exceptional. So, yeah, she's one that we've always thought a lot of, and she's never disappointed us.
Hey, Todd, over the weekend, you win all these stakes races, and there's a common theme, and it has been the case throughout 2021. No Lasix involved with any of these horses. They're all running in races where Lasix is not allowed. So you've probably had as much experience with horses going off Lasix or running without it as any trainer in the country. What's been your experience? Has it been difficult to manage? Do the horses bounce back quicker? Have you had any horses that maybe bled that wouldn't have done so if they had Lasix?
So I think, like everyone else, we're learning as we go, and you know, in a lot of these 3-year-old cases, they were not allowed to have Lasix as 2-year-olds. So you know, known agendas had LASIK once. And I think some people made a bigger deal out of that than it actually was when he kind of romped in against an overmatched group of A of the Dans at Gulfstream. But to specifically answer your question, I mean, we're having some cases where we have horses bleed without LASIKs. To be honest, we have horses that bleed sometimes with LASIKs, and sometimes they win and bleed. Sometimes they run poorly and bleed. So it's, you know, I think some people have the misconception that if you give a horse LASIKs, they will not bleed. And that's not always accurate. You know, some horses will bleed through LASIKs. So those horses, when they go off LASIKs, are probably a bigger issue. But we had a really good weekend in terms of, you know, all of our horses came back well and scope clean and you know, seemed to bounce out of the races with good energy. So I can't say that would be largely different if they'd have had LASIKs, but we're happy that they scoped the way they did and the way they bounced out of the races.
You know, when we last had you on the show, it was right after Vino Rosso won the Breeders' Cup Classic. But some of that race was marred by the breakdown of Mongolian Groom. And, you know, you didn't mince words on the show about, you know, how much better the sport needs to get when it comes to the safety of its horses. So that seems like a million years ago, you know, considering what's happened since then. But all this time later, it's a follow up. What do you think the racing world's done well in that regard? What do you think? What work do you think still has to be done?
Well, it's like we talked about then, you know, it's no breakdown, you know, one breakdown is too many, but, you know, we also live in a, you know, a real world where those things do happen. And so I think we've made a lot of improvements. I think, you know, the statistics are showing that the numbers are down, you know, and like I said, I think, you know, it's not a trainer thing. It's not a jockey thing. It's not a track veterinarian thing. It's an industry thing. And, you know, we have to do better from the ground up, from the time these horses are born to the way they're prepped for the sales, the way they're treated, you know, the whole way. So it's everyone's responsibility. And ultimately it comes down, you know, to the trainers making the decisions at entry time and race time. But, you know, I think the industry is recognized as a whole that we all have to do better. And that's why I think we're making improvements and hopefully not going to rest on our laurels of doing better. We got to keep getting better.
Todd, looking at your career to the point you're at now, you're 100% certainty to get elected into the Hall of Fame this year. You've won the Breeders' Cup Classic. You won the Kentucky Derby. You won the Belmont. You won numerous training titles at Saratoga and Gulfstream. But it's almost like, you know, what's left type of thing. But honestly, is there any like goals that you know, help you get out of bed in the morning? This is still something I want to achieve. So in the next 30 years or so of your career, you know, what are some of the things you'd like to do?
You know, I think it's a difficult business to set very specific goals. So like I've always said, you know, our primary goal is to do the very best we can with each individual horse and hopefully develop them to their full potential. But, you know, what, at this stage of your career, what excites you are the big races. And you know, these are the type of events leading up to the Kentucky Derby, for example, that, you know, you get charged up for because of the people that you're involved with, you know, whether it's the exercise riders or the staff or, you know, especially the owners, when they this is why they're in the business. These are the type of races that they dream of being in and hopefully winning. So, you know, to me, that's very exciting. That guy, that gets me going. And that's why I, you know, get up in the morning and we try to prepare these horses to get to those type of races.
Now, I just have one more question for you, Todd. And it's with regard to the Derby. Obviously, you're going to have, you know, possibly four entries in there. And a couple of the riders have you know, already committed to riding you. And you may have a couple of spots open for riders. Bill asked me the question earlier in the day of, you know, why did we choose a certain rider to ride certain races? I'm going to throw that question at you as well. I'm sure you're getting inundated by jockey agents calling you to ride a couple of these horses. How do you decide who's going to ride for you in the Kentucky Derby?
Well, a lot of it's about seeing who's available. And so, you know, we've got Kendrick on Bourbonic coming off a win. We've got IRED on Known Agenda coming off a win in the Florida Derby. So those two are easy. The other two, Dynamic One, Jose Ortiz rode him. He's been riding Greatest Honor. So, you know, most of these guys don't want to commit any sooner than they have to see, you know, who all actually makes the race. So you know, we'll survey who's available and try to match who we feel like is the best fit for each particular horse. And, you know, sometimes your best move is just to be patient, wait and see how things unfold.
One last question. I'm asking you to put your handicapping hat on, because we talk about the prospective Derby field every week, which I feel like we change our opinions weekly based on who the top contenders are. When you look at the race as someone who's going to be entering against these horses, who stands out to you as potentially your biggest competition right now?
Yeah, to me, the way I would rank, you know, is it's close at this point, but I would have to say is, you know, deemed essential quality. It's still at the, you know, at the number one. He's undefeated. He's coming off a strong race in the Bluegrass. I'm interested to see the Arkansas Derby, and if Concert Tour performs really well in there, you know, he's certainly in the top part. And then, you know, I think Known Agenda is a legitimate top three contender based on the strength of his Florida Derby. So that's kind of where I see the cream of the crop at this moment. But, you know, what's I always find very important is like, who's going to like Churchill. It can be a quirky surface. You'll see some horses take to it, like love it. Other horses don't handle it at all. So I'm interested to get our group there and have a couple breezes over the track, see how they handle it. And, you know, then it'll probably rain on race day and be a completely different track, and who knows, but
we've never seen that. I don't recall ever seeing that. All right, Todd, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it. Congratulations on all the success and best of luck in the Derby.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you, Todd. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Todd Pletcher will receive a free 1-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust the Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over 4 decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit the Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
Before we sign off, I wanted to just mention briefly the passing of Alice Chandler, who's, you know, one of the, I guess, the grand dam of Millridge and one of the founding women in American breeding. She was 95 years old. Her father, Hal Price Heedley, was Keeneland's first president. He died in 1962, left her 288 acres near Keeneland, and she founded Millridge Farm on the land that year. She bred the 1968 Epsom Derby winner, Sir Ivor, who ended up becoming a pretty good sire in his own right. And she received the Eclipse Award of Merit in 2009. Her son, Heedley Bell, runs Millridge now. And it's one of the premier nurseries in the world. They do a great job. So rest in peace to Alice Chandler and condolences to everybody who knew her. She was a popular lady in the industry. And she obviously was, like I said, one of the foundational women in the American breeding landscape. Okay, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember, the Keeneland Spring Meet is off and running. They're going to resume today. Nice card today. And they're going to run all the way through Sunday. The meet runs through April 23rd. It's obviously been great action so far. I'm going to look forward to the rest of the meet. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Todd Pletcher, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Ritz, and our editors, Aaliyah LaRocca, Anthony LaRocca, and Danny Seiper. Thank you so much for watching. Please wear a mask and get vaccinated if you can. We'll see you next week.